Ruth chapter 1, verse 22 through the second chapter, verse 3. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. There was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. So Ruth, the Moabitess, said to her, said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him, in whose sight I might find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." And she left, and she went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech.
Today is Sit and Service Sunday for the kids, so welcome aboard, kids. Glad to have you with us. Someone has said that three kinds of people in the world. There are those who make things happen, there are those who watch things happen, and then there are those who wonder what's happening. In our text this morning, Ruth is going to demonstrate that she's a woman who made things happen. She made things happen in spite of her circumstances, and as such, she'll be a good example for the rest of us. Let's set the stage for what's going on with Ruth in this text. She was a lady from Moab who had married a nice Jewish boy who had moved to her country in Moab. They got married, and I suspect that Ruth expected she would spend the rest of her days in Moab, but then circumstances took a different turn. Her husband died, her father-in-law died, her brother-in-law died. She found herself at home with her widowed mother-in-law Naomi and her widowed sister-in-law Orpah. Probably these three women were in desperate straits. There was no government safety net to help them in times like this. They were dependent upon the generosity of family or friends or anybody else who might have a heart to reach out to them. When Naomi decided to go back to Bethlehem, she did her best to convince both Orpah and Ruth to stay in Moab. Orpah, in fact, went home with her mom, but Ruth decided to go to Bethlehem with Naomi. They arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. What that tells us is it was springtime. Barley was harvested late March or early April. And by the way, Naomi apparently owned a piece of property. That's the property that was available for Boaz as the kinsman redeemer that Elimelech, her husband, had. That's probably where they lived. But the fact that they moved there during harvest time says they hadn't planted any crops, so there was nothing for them to harvest. That raised serious questions for them about what they would eat, how they might even survive. Their arrival was well-timed because the barley harvest had just started. There was food in Bethlehem. Now the challenge was how to get your hands on some of that food. Now, I told you a moment ago there was no government safety net. I thought I said that. Maybe I didn't say that. Boy, it may be one of those mornings I'm questioning, did I say that or not say that? And that's not strictly true, because there was a program set up by God to take care of the poor and the needy. Unlike welfare and food stamps in the United States, this was a work program. Remember that Israel was a theocracy, meaning that they were under God's command, and the law of Moses was the rule of the land. In the law of Moses, God had made provision for people who were poor during harvest time. So I'm going to give you kind of a quick legal brief of God's program for the poor. You can follow along if you like or just listen, but I'm going to go through this pretty fast. In Leviticus chapter 19, verse 9, we read these words. "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of the field. Neither shalt thou gather the gleanings of thy harvest. Thou shalt not glean thy vineyard. Neither shalt thou gather every grape of thy vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and for the foreigner. I am the Lord your God." Now, understand, back in those days, harvesting was done by hand. They didn't have air-conditioned combines and threshers and all the kind of nice things we have these days. It was all done by hand. So the harvester would go out, probably grab the stalk of barley with his left hand, cut it off with his right hand, stack it up, and they would come back and collect it later. I'm not a farmer, but I have read that that is not a very efficient or effective way to harvest crops. In fact, I have read that about 30% of the produce can get left behind in that kind of harvest. So God's program was that if you were poor, if you were a foreigner, if you were in need, you could follow along behind the harvesters in the fields. They would miss some, and you would glean whatever they left. And the idea was pick up whatever they left. That was God's program for the poor. I'm going to give you another passage. This is Leviticus 23, verse 22. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not make clean riddance of the corners of your field when you reap, neither shalt thou gather any gleaning of thy harvest. Thou shalt leave them to the poor and to the stranger, the foreigner. I'm the Lord your God. So again, God says, when you're harvesting, don't go back and pick up things that you left. Don't harvest clear to the corners. Leave some space for those who are poor, who have need behind you. And then finally, Deuteronomy 24, verse 19 says, when you cut down your harvest in the field and you forget a sheep in the field, don't go again to fetch it. That's for the stranger, for the fatherless, for the widow, that the Lord your God may bless thee in all the work of thine hands. God had a program for people who were poor. It was a work program. If you're hungry, you can go to the fields, you can pick up what the farmer missed. That was God's program. Now, I don't know how Ruth knew about that program because she was from Moab, and I seriously doubt they had such a program in Moab, but she did hear about it, and she determined to make the most of it. And in doing so, Ruth became a person who made things happen in spite of several obstacles. We're going to see three obstacles this morning that she overcame. Her mother-in-law was an obstacle, her nationality was an obstacle, and her gender was an obstacle. So let's talk about Naomi for a few moments. I don't really know what Ruth's mother-in-law was like, but so far I'm not impressed. I mean, last week we saw that when they said, hello, is this Pleasant? Which is what her name means. Her response was, don't call me Pleasant, call me Bitter. And then she went into this tirade about all that God had done against her. God has made me bitter. I went out full and God took it all away from me. I've come back empty. God has turned against me. God has broken me. Well, indeed, she was a bitter little old lady, wasn't she? That's the woman that we meet in chapter 1. That's the woman that Ruth moved in with and was living with in Bethlehem. One writer who does not have a high regard for Naomi said this. Naomi had been reduced to a state of emptiness with no one around to help her. The only one left was her pesky Moabitess daughter-in-law, Ruth. And she wasn't so sure that Ruth was more of an asset or an embarrassment. It had not been Naomi's idea for Ruth to come back to Israel with her. The last thing she wanted was one more mouth to feed and one more body to clothe. Now, that may sound a little harsh, but put yourself back in that context. It may not be too far from being accurate. See, in the culture in which they lived, Naomi was a proud Jewish lady. Jews were proud. They didn't like intermarrying with the pagans around them. But her son had married a Moabite girl, and the god of this Moabite girl was Chemosh, the fish god, whom the Israelites considered to be an abomination. So it's no stretch to think that Naomi might have been just a little bit embarrassed by her daughter-in-law. You know, I was trying to think of a way to illustrate that in our culture, and the best I can come up with is if you're a white woman and your son marries a black woman. Now, that's not as scandalous now as it might have been a few years ago, but I suspect there are plenty of white women who would still have an issue with that. That's the equivalent that we're looking at in this text. Now, Ruth was not a woman of color, but she was a woman from a different culture. She was from Moab. She was a foreigner. And one has to wonder if Naomi was really so proud of that little Moabite daughter-in-law. Maybe that's why she did her best to get both Orpah and Ruth to return to Moab. You remember she said four times in that passage, go back, go back, go back, go. And once she even said, go back to your gods. Kind of makes you wonder how proud she was of Ruth, doesn't it? So far, I've not seen anything out of Naomi that would make Ruth think, well, that was a great choice following Naomi. I'm sure glad I came with her. Let's read now in our text, chapter 2 and verse 2. Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me now go to the field and glean ears of corn. And now, by the way, when I hear corn, I think maize corn. And I love corn on the cob. It's not that. That's an old English use. It's the fruit. This is barley they're reaping, okay? They're not reaping corn. So just that's archaic. Someday I might give up the King James Bible so I don't have to explain things like that, but it'll probably be in heaven before I do that. So anyway, she says, I will go to the field and glean ears of corn after him in whose sight I shall find grace. Naomi said to her, go, my daughter. Does that sound a little terse to you? Let me now go and glean in the fields. Go ahead. There's no, what a great idea, Ruth. Would you really do that? Thank you so much. I was wondering how we would eat. Oh, that's such a good idea. Why don't I go with you? Maybe I couldn't gather much, but I could at least be with you. You wouldn't be alone. Nothing of that sort. It's just, go, my daughter. If you think that's terse in the English, it's just as bad in the Hebrew. It's just two words. Halach bot. Go, daughter. Truly. What a sweetheart. By the way, why didn't Naomi go with her to gather grain? She wasn't an old woman. I mean, we can guesstimate her age, and here's how we do that. We know that in that culture, it was not unusual that a girl was married by the time she's age 16. So let's say that Naomi got married when she was 16. There was no birth control, and so they just had babies when they had babies. So I'm going to guess probably by the time she's 20 years of age, she's had her two sons. I don't know how old her sons were when they married. Let's just say 16, 18, 17, somewhere in that range. So let's see. She's 16. She has her sons by the time she's 20. They marry probably by the time she's 38 or 40 years of age. What we know is that they were married for 10 years before they both died. So that puts Naomi's age at what? Are you keeping up with me here? Somewhere around 50 years of age. That's probably an educated, probably an accurate guess. 50 is not old. Now, some of you younger folks may think that's really old, but looking at it from this side of that's not so old. And it really wasn't that old in that culture either. She is not an old woman. Now, I think last week I said she was a bitter old woman. That's an expression. I didn't mean literally she was old. She just was old before her time because of the bitterness in her heart. Furthermore, she had walked home from Moab to Bethlehem. Now, as the crow flies, that was only about 50 miles. But you can't walk from Moab to Bethlehem as the crow flies because there's this body of water between these two places. Bethlehem is in south central Israel. Moab is on the other side, the east side of the Dead Sea. So to get there, you got to cross through the Dead Sea. Well, you don't cross through the Dead Sea. So she's walking back to Bethlehem from Moab. She'd have to walk north to get to the north side of the Dead Sea. She'd have to cross over the Jordan River someplace. She'd probably then pass through Jericho. Jericho, by the way, was notorious for this treacherous highway, this winding road that ran through Jericho. She would make her way down to Jerusalem and then walk another 5 miles to get home to Bethlehem. This would be at least a 100-mile walk. What that tells me is she is not disabled. She is of sound body. She didn't hop on a plane and fly. She didn't take a bus. She didn't take an Uber. She walked. She was healthy. She was strong. She was able. So why didn't she offer to go to the fields and help Ruth? And I don't know the answer to that question. Was it pride? Was she embarrassed to be seen with this little Moabite girl? Was she too good to go and beg? I don't know. But she sure didn't encourage Ruth, did she? Hey, mom-in-law, I think I'll go glean in the field today. Go ahead. Not much encouragement in that, is there? But see, Ruth was a woman who made things happen. In spite of her mother-in-law, she takes this bull by the horns and she goes and she makes things happen. She made things happen in spite of her mother-in-law. She made things happen in spite of her nationality. Now, I'm going to return to the nationality thing because I know I've said a few things about it along the way, but I'm going to come back to it because the text itself makes a big deal out of the fact that she was a Moabitess. In those four verses that Andrew read a few moments ago, that's mentioned twice. She's a Moabitess. She's a Moabitess. And the reason is because in that culture, that mattered. Now, the phrase Moabitess slips kind of right by us because, you know, Moabitess, Israelitess, no difference to us. So I'm going to read those verses again. But instead of Moabitess, I'm going to say Mexican. And I just want you to kind of hear how it feels. Whatever. Listen to how that changes the tone of this. So Naomi returned, and Ruth, the Mexican, her daughter-in-law with her, which returned out of the country of Mexico. And they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of barley harvest. And Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Mexican, said unto Naomi, let me now go to the field and glean the ears of corn after him in whose sight I shall find grace. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So I can't read that hardly without a sense of scorn in my voice. She's different. She's a Mexican. Now, I know in our culture we'd look at that and we'd say, so what? Yeah, but this wasn't our culture. This is about 1,300 years before Christ, in a land where nationality really mattered. If you were a foreigner, you were an outsider. Ruth was a foreigner. She was a Moabitess. She was second class. She was alien. She was foreign. She would be treated as second class, alien, and foreign. That's why the law of Moses made such a big deal out of leaving some of your crop in the field for the foreigners. Because God knew that most Jews would never do that on their own. God has a heart for the poor. God has a heart for the outcast. And so God, through the law, set up a system so that people like Ruth could be taken care of. Like it or not, a person's nationality can be a very serious obstacle. Now, that's weird for us because we're Americans. We're the melting pot. We're multicultural and all that jazz. But put yourself in Israel 1,300 years before Christ, where that really mattered. That's the situation that Ruth is in. It didn't matter. She was going to make things happen. Several years ago, I read a book called How to Be a Great Communicator in Person, on Paper, and at the Podium, written by a guy named Nito Cubain. I read those kinds of things periodically because that's the business I'm in. So I've read a lot of books about public speaking and platform skills and this and that. It's really one of the best I've read. Any of you ever heard of Nito Cubain? Well, if you ever get the chance to hear him, he's well worth hearing. Nito Cubain was born in 1948 in Lebanon. Not Lebanon, Missouri, but Lebanon, as in the war-torn Middle East. When he was 18 years of age, he moved to the United States. He had $50 in his pocket, and he spoke broken English. But he determined he was going to make something of himself in the United States, and he made good on it. He learned to speak flawless English, and he became a well-known motivational speaker. And see, if you were into motivational speaking, that's a name you would have heard. He draws people by the thousands when he speaks in public because he's such a compelling, motivational speaker. He's written 11 books. He's been a very successful businessman. Currently, he serves as president of the University of High Point in High Point, North Carolina. My point is this. He overcame his obstacles of being a foreigner and made something of himself. That's what Ruth is going to do. She will overcome. Her nationality was a serious obstacle. But she refused to let her nationality define her. She was a woman who had a need, and she was willing to overcome any obstacle to meet that need. The need was she had to eat. I mean, this is a culture where you just don't file for welfare. You just don't go down to some government office and walk out with food stamps. You got to do something or you're going to starve. This is a woman who made things happen. In spite of her mother-in-law, in spite of her nationality, and finally, in spite of her gender. me tell you a secret.
Men are different than women. Generally speaking, women are more vulnerable than men.
Oh, I know it's sexist, and it's not politically correct, but it's true. You know, truth is just one of those stubborn things that doesn't care about political correctness. Ruth is a woman in a culture where it really did matter. Several weeks ago, I went to Texas to watch one of our ladies train, the company I work with. I'm with a seminar company. And I went to two different hotels to watch her train. And in one of our conversations, we got to comparing notes about the different hotels we had been in that week. One was a La Quinta hotel, which is a moderately priced small chain of hotels. The other was a Hilton hotel, which is a higher price international chain of hotels. And as we were talking about it, she commented that the Hilton had lower reviews than the La Quinta. In fact, she said that Hilton we were in had the lowest reviews of any hotel she'd been in that week. And I think she spent five nights in five different hotels. And I kind of looked at her incredulous because I said, you look at hotel reviews? She says, I certainly do. First thing she does when she gets her itinerary where she's going is she gets online and checks the reviews of the hotels she's going to be in. I have never done that once in my life. And she looked at me and she said, the reason you have never done that is because, quote, you're a man, end quote. And it really kind of surprised me because she's kind of on the left end of the spectrum. I mean, I know a little bit about this lady, and that's really sexist to say. But it's true. True. I don't worry about those things. I mean, if my company says, this is where you're going, well, okay. Doesn't matter what the internet says about it. I'm going there, so I just go. The reason she checks is because as a woman, she's vulnerable. Well, put yourself in Ruth's shoes. You're a female foreigner in a foreign country, and you have nothing. There is a legal provision that gives you the right to go into a farmer's field and pick up what their harvesters left behind. You don't want to do this, but you're desperate. You're looking starvation in the face. You've got to eat. So you go. And along the way, you feel the stares of those who know you're different. She's not one of us. And I suspect along the way she felt the leers of the men who saw this foreign woman. There is some reason in the text to think she was not only a foreign woman, she was also an attractive foreign woman. Let's jump ahead in the text. Let me show you. Chapter 2, verse 8. Then said Boaz to Ruth, "Hearest thou not my daughter? Go not to glean in another field, neither go from hence, but abide here fast by my maidens. Let thine eyes be on the field that they do reap. Go thou after them." This next phrase is what I'm driving for. "Have I not charged the young men that they shall not touch thee?" What's that mean? Well, it could mean he doesn't want his men being physically hurtful to her. Sometimes these gleaners would get in the way and men would push them aside. So you could say that's what it is. But do you think that's what that is? This same word is used in the book of Proverbs, where it says, "Whoever touches an adulteress shall be punished." How do you touch an adulteress? And don't answer that question. It has sexual connotations. This is, as one writer said, the first sexual harassment policy in the workplace ever. And it's right here in the book of Ruth, 1,300 years before Christ. Bible's cutting edge. So you don't have to worry about this book being out of date. It thought about that long before anybody else thought about that. Boaz's concern is that his men not sexually abuse her. She was vulnerable, probably an attractive young woman, but she took the initiative and she made things happen. In spite of her mother-in-law, in spite of her nationality, in spite of her gender, she wasn't content to watch things happen. She was intent on making things happen. Wonder what that says to you. What is there in your life that you need to make happen? How about that daily walk with God? That time in His Word? That time of prayer? What about that besetting sin that keeps tripping you up? When are you going to take control of this and make it happen that you conquer that sin? What about that grudge you have against that person that has wronged you? When are you going to take control of this? And when are you going to make it happen that you deal with those emotions and those feelings? Ruth was a woman that made things happen. I was thinking about all the sermons I've heard in my life. I've heard a lot of them. I mean, I grew up at Youth for Christ from the time I was in junior high to graduating. I heard sermons every Saturday night in addition to what I heard on Sunday mornings. Then I went to Moody Bible, and so I've just heard a lot of sermons. There's a handful that really stand out. One that really stands out was preached by a guy named David Ring. David Ring was born with cerebral palsy. Cerebral palsy is a phenomenon where the brain is normal, but the connection between the brain and the motor functions of the body are not normal. And so their movements often appear stilted and awkward because the motor functions just are not in sync with the brain. It affects the way they speak. The person with cerebral palsy, they think clearly, but to be able to express it clearly is very difficult for them. So their speech is often labored and slow, and there's a frustration because sometimes you want to finish their sayings for them. David Ring got saved when he was a teenager, and he felt that God had called him to preach. But wait a minute, people with cerebral palsy don't preach? You can't hardly talk. How are you going to preach? But he felt that's what God wanted him to do. So he overcame the obstacles, and he became a preacher. And I tell you, he's one of the most powerful preachers I've ever heard. He's hard to listen to. You have to listen closely because the words don't just flow. They're labored. And there are times you think, okay, I think what you're trying to say is spit it out. But I tell you what, when I saw him, it was at the pastor's conference at Moody Bible Institute there on North LaSalle Street in the Torrey Gray Auditorium. 1,600 pastors were in this auditorium listening to this young man preach. He told his life story. He told about all the obstacles he had had to overcome. God called him to preach, but he had to overcome things that none of us knew anything about. I'd never had to wrestle with being able to talk. I mean, you just stand up there and you talk. And the man went on and on about this problem and that problem and the other problem that he had had to overcome. And then he reached the climax of his sermon and he paused. And he looked out over that sea of pastors. And he asked this question. What's your problem? And I tell you, you could hear a pin drop in that place. What's my problem indeed? He overcame so many obstacles. What excuse do I have for not overcoming the problems in my life? What problems are you facing? What obstacles have you allowed to become excuses for not doing what God wants you to do? People can be divided into three groups. There are those who make things happen. There are those who watch things happen. And there are those who wonder what's happening. Which one are you? And today, will you pick up your responsibilities and make it happen to the glory of God? Let's pray together, shall we? Father, I thank you for this little lady, Ruth. I thank you that nothing got in her way. She just did what needed to be done. I pray we'd follow her example to the glory and honor of Christ, in whose name I pray. Amen.